What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Welcome to The Exchange. I'm John Fortin. Here is what's ahead. Stocks lower, yields higher. The 10-year up by more than 13 basis points on the first trading day after the Fed's key inflation read showed prices moderated in February. But spending remained resilient. And manufacturing grew in March for the first time in 16 months. Our economist sees three rate cuts still on the table this year, and she's going to make her case ahead of Friday's jobs report. Manufacturing in China also expanding, breaking five straight months of contraction. But is it a blip thanks to the Lunar New Year holiday, or is the country on the brink of a recovery? We're going to discuss whether the bottom is really in. Plus, Macy's pain is whose gain? The troubled retailer planning to close 150 stores over the next few years. We'll take a look at the companies that stand to win those customers. But we begin today with the market action. Let's get over to Dom Chu with the numbers. Dom.
All right, it started off positive. We lost some steam, John, during this session so far as the early afternoon kicks off. So you can see right across the screen, we're down roughly 0.2% for the Dow Industrials. That's 260 downside points, 39,546 the last trade there. The S&P 500, the broader measure, at 5237. That's down 16 points, roughly 0.3% declines there. Meanwhile, remember, at the highs of the session, just to give you context, we were up 9 points in the S&P, so modest, and then down about 25 at the low. So again, modest moves here, but still to the downside. The NASDAQ composite, the tech-heavier index, is just about flat on the session, down about 0.1%, 16,367 the last trade there. One place where there is decidedly a good amount of green is in gold prices. COMEX gold futures, they get a star right here. They hit an all-time high earlier today. 22.58 is the last trade. They're up almost 0.1%. If you take a look at the trade overall, we are not far from the highs that we saw intraday. So a sharp move higher there just off the session highs. We'll keep an eye on those gold prices. A narrative of perhaps more rate cuts down the line, perhaps more inflationary pressure, adding to some of those, along with that kind of safety trade haven element. Gold's a very strange beast these days. Nonetheless, it's up big. And then check out what's happening right now with mega cap technology. A huge part of the story for the last several years, and certainly in the first quarter. It's the reason why we had such a great quarter there. But names like Alphabet, Amazon, Apple in focus today. On Alphabet and Amazon, you've got analysts coming out with their tactical picks for the second quarter. B of A likes the Google parent company, Alphabet. Amazon's getting a tactical buy signal or call over at Wells Fargo. Both of those stocks are up. Alphabet, remember, has been an underperformer. And then Apple, I know you guys, John, are going to talk about this later on, down about 1%. But a number of analysts out there with commentary about whether or not Apple can recover from this. This is going to be a big story. We'll see if they carry that trade in the second quarter. John, I'll send things back over to you.
All right. It's the time for questions about Apple again. Dom, thanks. Meantime, yields higher today as markets process some fresh economic data and look ahead to big reports this week. And our senior economics reporter, Steve Leisman, joins with what's driving those moves. Steve?
Hey, John, yeah, the combination of data, Fed speak, and technicals inside the bond market now calling into question the market's belief in a June Fed rate cut. Take a look here. The probability of a June rate hike trading just above even money at 57%, even the lowest level, the lowest levels we've seen after trading near 75% 2 weeks ago and 62% last week. So it's a sinking probability there. What's more, the futures market now growing, in fact, more hawkish than the Fed itself is. The January Fed funds contract trading at 466. That's above Fed officials' own median forecast of 4.6 for the year-end funds rate. It is just a bit above, but it had been below for a very long time. All of this happening alongside a surge in yields of both the 2 and the 10-year. The 2-year rising a strong 9 basis points where it closed on Thursday afternoon. While yields started the morning higher, they got an extra boost from stronger than expected ISM manufacturing data in the rearview mirror. That is, the February inflation report is apparently not looking as benign as some thought, including the Fed chair, thought it might be. Looking ahead, though, the jobs report is forecast to show a weakening in payrolls, but to a still strong 200,000. The unemployment rate forecast to dip a tenth to 3.8, while wage growth picks up month to month, down year over year. There's plenty to bother the bond market here. You got a lot of supply. You have an outlook for inflation that's uncertain, and the Fed. The rise in yields is also happening in the context, John, of improving growth, which looks to be helping stocks in the face of these higher yields. And just one more data point, the Atlanta Fed boosting first quarter GDP to 2.8%. That is up a half a point on the stronger data, John.
Yeah, so Steve, it looks like we went from good news is bad news on the economy versus, you know, stocks to good news is good news to maybe now good news is so-so.
Or what about this? What if good news is good news for the stock market and good news is bad news for the bond market? I will point out that you have these higher yields and they have been going higher. The stock market, yeah, it's off a little bit today, but not the kind of off you would have with 9 basis points. And then also take a look, John, at what's happening, the DXY, the dollar, up over 105 right now, which is a pretty strong number. And I'll agree with Dom, the part where he said gold is weird these days. It is rallying in the face of fewer rate cuts expected. It usually goes the other way. And there's that dollar at 105, the DXY index, John.
All right. Steve Leisman, thank you. And now, sure. Both my next guests believe the Fed is on track to start rate cuts mid-year. One says more accommodative monetary policy will be a potential driver of the next bull run in equities. And joining me now, Stephanie Roth, chief economist at Wolfe Research, and Katerina Simonetti, senior VP and private wealth advisor at Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. Good afternoon to both of you. Stephanie, the economy doesn't need below trend growth now for a soft landing to happen, you say. What does that mean for the Fed's flexibility on cuts?
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen is you can have strong growth and inflation that continues to moderate. So we're getting this non-inflationary growth, which is what we saw on Friday in the PCE report. PCE came in at 0.26%. The street was looking for 0.3%. And the surprise really was on the consumer side, which came in really quite robust. So we've seen these trends where the supply side of the economy continues to rebound, and that's allowed strong growth and inflation to continue to moderate. We very much believe that January was largely driven by seasonality, and the Fed is leaning on that too, which is why the Fed's likely to still be able to cut in June. We don't have to necessarily be scared of these stronger data points because inflation continues to remain really quite modest.
Okay, so Katerina, what does that mean for fixed income? I keep hearing that wealthy investors are looking to lock in these higher yields increasingly at longer durations.
Absolutely. John, rates are on the way down. Now, we might not know the timing, and we might be unable to predict whether Fed is going to have, you know, 3 rate cuts this year or 2 rate cuts this year. But we know that rates are going towards, you know, the lower points. So investors are taking in these opportunities to lock in higher rates, both on the municipal side and on the corporate side, and extend the duration because, you know, let's face it, the 5% money market is something that we feels like has been around forever, but it's only been here for a short time frame. And we need to know that, you know, this is something that's not going to last. So both on the stock side, when we need to take advantage of the buying opportunities, you know, in the quality sector, the sectors of the market that didn't have the run up yet, you know, and also some, you know, decent amount of profit taking in the sectors and in individual positions that had big run up. And when our clients are asking us where should they allocate, you know, these profit taking proceeds, we tell them take a look at the fixed income and take advantage of the higher rates.
I'm still not bored with 5%. It's still exciting to me. I don't know. Stephanie, the spending from the consumer continues to be such an important part of the picture here. But I don't know. I keep looking over at the debt levels and the defaults that are starting to pile up. But then the jobs picture is pretty strong. So does that sort of keep things in balance for the economy?
Yeah, as long as the job market remains firm, then the consumer will keep spending. They'll spend in line with their income growth, which is are in real terms should be somewhere around 2 to 2.5%, and then the economy should hold up just fine. So you've started to see some pickup in delinquencies, but that shouldn't be an issue as long as the consumer is employed. And what we've seen so far is the labor market has been incredibly robust, and that should remain the case because company profit margins are really quite high. And there's no reasons for companies to do massive layoffs if their margins are quite healthy, and in which case the labor market should continue to be solid. The biggest expenses that companies have are capital spending and employment. And as long as their margins are healthy, they're going to keep spending on that. And we should see that throughout the course of this year.
So, Katerina, speaking of profit margins, you're particularly focused on stocks of companies that have shown operational efficiency and look to continue that. How are you filtering through that, and what are you most focused on there?
John, there has been a lot of conversation about AI lately, and in our minds, it's not just a gimmick. You know, we see AI as something, as this pivot that can really bring operational efficiency and competitive positioning to the companies across the sector, specifically in financial services, in healthcare, in defense, in utilities. And so, you know, when we look at the companies that are increasing profitability, that are responsible with their costs, and also that are, you know, delivering attractive valuations, in our view, this is where, you know, the portfolios should be positioned. And this is the good time, you know, especially after this run-up in the market that we saw in such a short time frame, to take a look and make sure that our portfolios are appropriately balanced, because this is really the key factor that is going to, you know, play a huge role in the long-term profitability, but also in the risk management side.
Okay. And you say consumer staples, healthcare, and utilities are the sectors you're most focused on.
That's right. But we also just increased our position in energy to overweight because of the consumer demand and attractive valuations. So another sector to be considered.
All right. Thank you, Stephanie Roth and Katerina Simonetti. Meantime, industrial giants GE and 3M are spinning off parts of their businesses this week. Just the latest in a growing corporate trend. And Seema Modi is back. Welcome back, Seema.
Thank you, John. I've had a lot of great experiences, but nothing compares to being a parent. Which
it's like your own spinoff, yeah.
Yeah, it is, exactly. We need more of them, actually. But speaking of what's happening in the industrial space, we're seeing a number of spinoffs, and they're all happening for different reasons. So, for example, 3M spinning off its healthcare business, its highest margin business, due to the liabilities it was facing on PFAS and earplugs. The company will receive $7.7 billion dividend from this spinoff, which will make it tax-free for shareholders. The company still owns a 19% stake in Solventum, which it will monetize over time. The industrial giant will welcome a new CEO next month, Bill Brown of L3Harris, who Melius analysts say will be taking a page out of Larry Culp's playbook and turning around, or trying to turn around, a great American company. Speaking of Culp, simplifying GE's story has won him praise, from selling biopharma, spinning off healthcare, and now on the verge of divesting its energy business tomorrow. Shares of GE, meantime, have gained about 40% this year. According to Goldman Sachs' David Dubner, who heads up M&A restructuring, he says higher interest rates, fewer private equity deals, and shareholder activism have all contributed to more spinoffs this year. We've seen about 15 in 2024 spinoffs, and that compares to the 8 deals that we saw in the first quarter of last year. So we're seeing more come to the table.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's been such a moribund IPO market, the idea that large companies would find this a comfortable market to spin things up. But we saw Intel a while ago do it with Mobileye. They're planning to do another one with the FPGA business. It's operating clearly by different rules, I guess.
It is. And then there's Western Digital looking to spin off its flash business. That's mostly due to Elliott Management and, again, activism playing a role there. So there are different reasons many companies are finding this to be a go-to strategy, one way to unlock value that they think is hidden from the market. And another reason is just to make it more appetizing or attractive to retail investors who want more simplified ways to invest in stock stories.
And I guess, like you seem to allude to right there, if you've got a couple pieces of the business that have different margin profiles or different growth profiles, it's an attractive environment to try to point that out.
Yeah, I mean, we keep saying it, but bigger may not always be better for a lot of these companies. And that's why taking a simplified approach may actually work out better over time. In fact, the data does support that from Goldman Sachs that shows that 1 year after a company spins off, it tends to outperform its parent company by around 6%.
Okay. They argue for getting smaller, and then they argue for getting
bigger. It just depends. Seasonality.
Seema, thanks. By the way, do not miss an exclusive interview with the CEOs of GE and GE Vernova. That's tomorrow morning on Squawk on the Street at 9:30 a.m. Eastern. Now coming up, China manufacturing is growing at its fastest pace in more than a year, boosting those stocks to their best day in more than a month. Does this mark a bottom in the Chinese markets? We will debate. Plus, Macy's downsizing its department store footprint. Does that open the door for its off-price competitors? We're going to look at the opportunities and challenges ahead when the Exchange comes right back.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Welcome back to The Exchange. The Shanghai Composite climbing more than 1% today and up about 3% this year after the latest economic data signaled the recovery there might be gaining traction. According to a private survey, China's factory activity came in at 51.1 in March, the fastest pace in 13 months. Meanwhile, the official manufacturing PMI was 50.8, the strongest reading since last March. And my next guest says this could mark a bottom for Chinese stocks. Joining me now with more is Marco Papich, the senior strategist at Clock Tower Group. Marco, welcome. So on top of all this, the China Securities Regulatory Commission has a new chairman over the last couple months, and that historically tends to mark a bottom. Should we believe it this time?
No, I think eventually the answer will be yes. My concern right now is that while we've had a pickup in manufacturing activity, which is really a global phenomenon, by the way, you saw that in the U.S. as well this week, the problem is the domestic economy really relies on credit growth and total social financing. The TSF number that we all watch when we think about China, it's actually down 12% for the combined January and February months, which takes out the effect of their new year. And that's the problem, because that's the lowest reading since 2012. So the stocks have bounced back on rumors of policy support, but we actually haven't seen any fiscal support thus far. So I think this rally will have to go back to the bottom of January, and then I think you will have a great entry point later this year in Chinese equities.
You mentioned the comparison in manufacturing growing both in the U.S. and China. I wonder about the credit versus capacity comparison as well. I mean, we're seeing more and more consumers in the U.S. use more and more credit. That's spending beyond their means. Is that a concern in China as well?
Yeah, it is, because they've been doing it for 10 years. You see, so this is a very important point. And I mean, you nail it right there. In the U.S., we've had 10 years of deleveraging. So the private sector, by 2020, was pretty much done with about a decade of deleveraging. So your point that they're taking on credit, that's true, but it's not yet in a dangerous territory, because in the U.S. we've been only doing it for about 4 years. And on top of that, U.S. households got that $3 trillion worth of stimulus, 2020, 2021. In China, they are where we were 10 years ago. And so they're in that decade of deleveraging, and that's why we're constantly being disappointed by their credit data. And that's why I think it's very difficult to invest in anything in China that depends on domestic economy. Now, externally focused companies, Chinese companies that are selling abroad, they're benefiting from American consumption and European recovery. And that can be an investment strategy, I think, for the remainder of this year and into next year.
Well, what's the strategy? What's the sense in investing in an externally focused Chinese company versus investing in the market that that company tends to focus on?
Well, you know, it's like, for example, the situation in Germany. Right now, the DAX is at all-time highs, the German equity market, even though German economy is effectively in a recession. And so if you have externally oriented equities and indices, they can do well even if the domestic economy is suffering. So in China's case, there will be a lot of EV manufacturers, battery supply chain, alternative energy companies. They should do well anyways. Plus, because of the situation at home, the currency, renminbi, is quite weak, which makes those companies quite competitive. Of course, there's tariff pressures, there's politics, there's nationalism, protectionism. Those are all big long-term risks. But for the next 6 to 18 months, these companies can do very well. However, for most investors listening to this, you know, this is way too detailed of an investment strategy. I would just say, look, the bottom line here is that domestic credit is not confirming a rebound in China. And on top of that, the government is imposing austerity, kind of like we did in 2010, 2011, when the Tea Party came to power. You know, same things are happening in China. They're actually trying to narrow their budget deficit at the same time the private sector is deleveraging. So if you're just trying to buy Chinese equities, I would punt on this tactical rally, and I would wait for policymakers to commit much bigger support for the real economy.
Okay. Yeah, that's part of what I was wondering about when you started pointing out those names in those industries that might tend to do well, because it seems to me whenever there are some companies or some industries in China that are doing well when the overall economy is not, that's just the inviting the government, the Communist Party, slapping them down, making an example of them. Remember Jack Ma? Remember when he used to dance?
No, that's for sure. And look, Chinese government has priorities. It's hard tech over soft tech. So it's really all about manufacturing. It's about competing with American and European manufacturers. So I would stay away from internet companies, which, by the way, have done very well over the last couple of months in this rally. And that's another reason why I don't think this current rally is really sustainable.
Okay. So if you've been in those names, it sounds like you would suggest maybe getting out of them or having a strategy to get out of them and into that more hard tech that the Chinese government tends to view as more strategic if you're going to play in China at all.
If you're going to play in China at all, that would be a good strategy. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. And then what about the overall environment in the region? How is that affected by these dynamics in China?
You know, it's very interesting. Japanese equities have been one of the biggest beneficiaries of just the entire thesis that China is uninvestable. You hear a lot from very large allocators managing hundreds of billions of dollars. They've basically extracted themselves out of China for a number of reasons. The things that you're talking about, government interference in the free market, American, of course, focus on China as a geopolitical rival. So a lot of large allocators have basically gone to two equity markets. India, if they require an emerging market allocation, or Japan, if they're just moving in their global asset allocation. So on the Japanese side, we've seen a very good performance by Japanese equities over the last 18 months. I think that will continue. I think Japan as an economy is well geared for the kind of a macro context we're in. Lots of things are being built, lots of industrialization everywhere. You're gonna need somebody to pick up the slack from China from that kind of manufacturing perspective. And I think that these dynamics will likely continue. India could be at risk, by the way. Mm. It is a very expensive market. So if you're trying to pick and choose between emerging markets and China actually puts a bottom with fiscal support by the government, look out for Indian equities. They could actually start underperforming.
Okay. They have been performing well. So we'll watch out for that. Marco Papich with Clock Tower Group. Thank you. Now, still ahead, Apple shares coming off their worst month since September. The stock has yet to post a positive month to start the year. And one Wall Street firm says the fall is far from over. The details and where there might be more weakness ahead. And as we go to break, here's a look at some of the names hitting all-time highs today, including Micron, General Dynamics, Alphabet, Progressive, and Diamondback Energy. But it's not all green out there. Stocks are lower across the board. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ near session lows. We're back after this.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click. Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome back to The Exchange with major indices near session lows. Time for some show and tell, where we show you a chart and tell you a story. This one has some suspense. Disney shares slightly lower ahead of Wednesday's annual meeting, where Trian's Nelson Peltz hopes to win a pair of seats on Disney's board of directors. The stock is coming off its best quarter since 2000, up 35% to start the year. But if Peltz wins the proxy fight and CEO Bob Iger leaves the company as a result, Disney board member Carolyn Everson told Squawk on the Street this morning it could mean trouble ahead.
I think that would be a terrible outcome for Disney. We're talking the future of Disney is at stake here. That is why this vote is so important. Bob is just in the midst with his leadership team of a massive transformation of Disney.
All right. Now to Tyler Matheson for CNBC News Update. Ty.
All right, John, thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Iran's consulate in the Syrian capital, Damascus, was destroyed today in a suspected Israeli airstrike. That is according to Syrian and Iranian state media. Israel has not commented, but has carried out strikes on government-controlled parts of Syria for years. Reuters reported that a senior commander in Iran's Quds force was killed in the strike. President Biden will visit Baltimore Friday to visit the site of the Francis Scott Key Bridge that collapsed last week. The president will meet with state and local officials and get a look at the federal response efforts there as the White House works with the state to reopen the port and eventually rebuild that bridge. And after an Easter weekend storm stranded motorists near Big Sur in California, traffic on California's iconic Highway 1 is slow but open once again. Parts of the highway collapsed during the storm south of Monterey, sending chunks of the road tumbling into the ocean and leaving some motorists stranded overnight. The famous route, beautiful road, has been prone to frequent closures from weather impacts in recent years. John, back to you.
And even in not so recent years, Tyler, thank you. Coming up, Macy's closing a quarter of its stores across the country as part of its turnaround strategy. But between closures, layoffs, and pressure from activist investors, is the company's pain its competitors' gain? We're going to tell you which brands could benefit the most next. And there's still time to register for the inaugural CNBC Changemakers event in New York City on April 18th. We're going to hear from some of the women transforming business, including Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo. To request an invite, you can scan the QR code on the screen or go to cnbcevents.com/changemakers. Be right back. Shares of Macy's up a little more than a percent since announcing its plans to close about 150 stores. That's more than a quarter of its U.S. locations back in February. And those closures could create an opportunity for other retailers to swoop in and gain market share. Joining me now to discuss who will come out on top, Corey Tarlow, head equity analyst at Jefferies, covering discount and specialty retailers, along with CNBC.com reporter Melissa Repko. Guys, welcome. Melissa, set this up for us. There are a lot of TJ Maxx stores close to Macy's stores. TJ Maxx, TJX, has been doing well. Macy's haven't. Why is that? I mean, when I think Macy's, I think malls. And when I think TJX, I think strip malls. I don't know if that has anything to do with it.
It comes down to a couple of things. People like strip malls, and they're just perceived as more convenient for people. And so some of it comes down to the same sort of thing as real estate, you know, location, location, location. And if people want to get in, get out quickly, being in a place where they are grocery shopping, like a TJ Maxx, is more convenient than circling around looking for a parking space at the mall where Macy's is. So that's a factor here. The other dynamic is that people are looking for a deal. And a lot of the brands are very similar at Macy's and TJ Maxx, but people can get them for cheaper.
Corey, weigh in here too, because when I look across the discount space, not everybody's doing well. I don't remember which one it is, Dollar General or Dollar Store. Somebody's closing a bunch of stores while somebody else is doing well. So it's not all about
mall malaise. What's the difference?
I think with off-price specifically, this is a concept, given their rather opportunistic buying model, the convenience and small format of these stores, it generally bodes well for consumers across various income demographics because they offer a good, better, best assortment, specifically at TJ Maxx, that's relatively close to a lot of consumers' homes in the U.S. And as you think about these prices that are 40 to 70% off conventional brands that you'd find in department stores, it tends to make the value offering very attractive given the value and proximity.
Okay, Melissa, it was Dollar Tree and Family Dollar that I was trying to remember, closing about 1,000 stores right now. How are they doing that while TJX is doing pretty well? I think there are other retailers who are off-price who are doing particularly well. I can't remember which one just reported earnings. You probably do. Is it staffing? Is it, again, location? Is it just the assortment that they're able to put out there?
You have to think about the customer. So compared to a Dollar Tree or a Dollar General, Macy's has a more affluent shopper, and that's why there's more overlap with TJX and even brands like Target or the higher-end customer that goes to Kohl's. And Jeffrey's actually looked at this, Corey looked at this, that, you know, if you look at where that customer shops, it's not just that they're looking for price, they're also looking for some of those more higher-end names. And so that explains why we're seeing growth of some retailers and closures of others. Like, I spoke to Target CEO Brian Cornell, and he mentioned Macy's and the closure and the opportunity that he sees for Target. And he said, you know, this is an opportunity we've had before when we've seen boxes close, like Toys R Us in the past. We've moved into some of those locations, and now this is kind of playing out again, but with a different name. Of course, Macy's is saying, as we close stores, we're going to invest in ones that are better performing. So they're saying these ones are already underperforming and perhaps already losing market share to TJX and others.
Corey, is it me, or is this a time of unusual volatility at the high and low end for the consumer? Aspirational luxury is taking a hit right now, and a lot of luxury brands are having to focus in on that core customer who's still going to spend. And we're talking about the difference here in discounters as well.
Well, one of the things that's been quite popular nowadays has been trade down. And you see it from regular specialty stores into off-price. You're seeing it within certain channels like Walmart, where consumers are trading down from brands to private label. I actually just last week hosted meetings with Walmart and Target executives with investors here in Manhattan. And what we saw was, even at those largest retailers, consumers are continuing to trade down into private label. At Walmart, that's a $100 billion business on a $600 billion enterprise. At Target, it's roughly a third of the mix, and it's continuing to grow. And these businesses are continuing to invest in private label. And you're seeing trade down from a lot of those higher, more luxury brands into this category that also helps support better margins too. And so that should bode really well for both sales and profitability ahead for a lot of these retailers.
Corey mentions a really good point that with discretionary spending, that is under pressure. And that cuts across the board from everyone from Macy's to Walmart. But Walmart is better positioned because of having that stronger private label brand and having more of a value reputation, kind of like a TJX. That being said, you know, some of the players like Kohl's, I spoke to Kohl's CEO Tom Kingsbury. He's saying we can grow as Macy's shrinks. But, you know, worth noting that the Kohl's is under pressure as well and is seeing people buy fewer clothing items, fewer shoes. And it's fair to say they're losing some share to TJX as well.
Corey, where does digital and omnichannel fit into the picture here?
It's a great question, John. I think that one of the most important things to note about digital and omni is that in the off-price landscape, it's actually relatively non-existent. So Burlington had an online presence and they actually got rid of it. Ross is completely in stores, and TJ Maxx has a very modest online assortment that we estimate accounts for a very small percentage of sales. So in spite of the uptick that we've seen in digital, Target's digital penetration has gone from high single digits now close to around 18% or close to 20%. Walmart's digital penetration has continued to rise. That's run rating at $100 billion business online. Off-price, it's much less meaningful. Why? Because these businesses want to drive brand-protected sales that is not necessarily visible entirely online to consumers broadly, so that off-price can serve as an effective clearance mechanism for a lot of brands that need to get rid of excess inventory.
All right. I guess one size doesn't fit all. Corey, Melissa, thank you. For Melissa's story, once again, go to CNBC.com. Now coming up, it's been a volatile month for Apple. Shares down more than 5%, and Loop Capital sees more pain ahead, saying street estimates for iPhone sales and revenue could be 20% too high for the June quarter. Just how far could Apple fall? Well, that's next. Welcome back to The Exchange. Apple, one of the worst performers in the Magnificent Seven this year, might now just be the Fab Four, down nearly 12% in the past 3 months, and more negative sentiment from Wall Street today. But could there be some upcoming positive catalysts for the tech giant? Well, Steve Kovac joins us now for today's Tech Check. Steve, on the one side, I won't say on the one hand.
The other hand.
Yeah, because it's Monday. We've got iPhone weakness. We've got this DOJ suit. On the other side, we've got high loyalty, WWDC, the developer conference coming up, and Apple tends to be very practical about trends like AI, and we haven't really seen their play yet.
Yeah, and so we don't know. That's the big question looming ahead. But today's news is this Loop price target cut down to 170. They were as high as, I think, 185 pretty recently. And they're basically saying calendar year 2024, sales and earnings could be down. And that they're saying that hasn't happened since 2016. And look, a lot of it is happening in China. We know the economy is in rough shape over there. We know in the December quarter for Apple, sales were down 13% overall. And just drilling down on just the iPhone in China, really bad data coming out for the first bit of the year. The most recent data, we have February numbers now, some estimates saying that iPhone sales were down as much as 16% for February. We don't know March yet. And of course, we'll get earnings in about a month or so here. But the thing is, when does China turn around and how can it turn around? You know, Tim Cook was out in China last month and, you know, met with at the business forum, opening up a new store. Does the consumer turn around there? And then the other question is, of course, what is this AI announcement that we're expecting to come at WWDC? How does that drive, again, iPhone sales? And then further out, September, we have the regular iPhone event, the iPhone 16. What can that do on the AI front that makes people want to upgrade? Not because, you know, they need a new phone, but because they want the new iPhone and maybe they'll upgrade a little sooner than expected.
We've got the China situation that's not necessarily just about the Chinese economy. We see some possibilities that that could be turning more positive, but also about Chinese sentiment toward a company like Apple.
And a little company called Huawei is causing problems for Apple, too. And they started making phones again last year. And we've seen evidence that they're eating into Apple's market share. You know, for the first couple years throughout COVID, Apple, when Huawei stopped making phones, we heard a lot from Apple about how many people in China were switching from Android back to iPhone. And now we're kind of seeing it go the other way. So that is another one. Loop points out as well. Don't count out Xiaomi, by the way, which is often referred to as the Apple of China, also causing pressure and more competition. So, yeah, there could be a little bit of nationalistic buying mm-hmm. on that sense. And also just, you know, literally Huawei fans excited that there's a new Huawei phone that they can buy. That's definitely hurting them. By the way, those are cheaper phones.
For investors, though, who are wondering when there might be an entry point for Apple, I can't help but notice that Apple has some advantages in the AI era. One, everybody, you know, Google, Microsoft, want placement on the iPhone and are willing to pay for it. So
pay a lot of money, too.
Yeah, billions upon billions of dollars for it. And then also, a lot of what these companies are doing are trying to vertically integrate in order to get better performance out of AI. Apple's already vertically integrated. They design their own chips and hardware and software. When they make a move in AI, it could be a very fast move.
And just that. But then the question becomes, as we heard 2 weeks ago, that they're partnering with Google again, or likely to partner with Google, and in China, likely to partner with Baidu. So what does that relationship look like? Which ways? That seems like almost better for Google than it is for Apple. You know, if they're relying on that, it gives Google more. That's why we've seen Google or Alphabet shares recover so much the last 2 weeks on this news, that it either gives them more exposure for Gemini AI, or they're going to collect money from Apple as Apple, if Apple ends up licensing Gemini for all these users too. So that becomes a real question. What kind of vertical integration do they have? What is their own internal AI thing? And we might not hear that till the next iPhone cycle, because I can bet you what they'll do something like, okay, if you want the best AI stuff, you got to buy that pro model.
You really think Apple's going to pay, though, or is Google going to have to pay for the privilege?
It feels like they would. I feel like it would be the other way around. We just don't know. But yeah. Yes, of course, they want access to, you know, a billion plus iPhone users. Of course, but it's a good thing for them either way. And that's already baked into them. They pay billions of dollars to all these other platforms in order to be dominant on this platform. So by the way, DOJ doesn't like that.
Right.
Yeah.
DOJ doesn't like much.
No.
These days. Lots of big companies doing big things. Steve Kovac, thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
Well, coming up, Mag7 stocks managing to eke out a gain today, building on the first quarter's nearly 18% gain. Up next, we'll get a look at some of the quality names one trader says have been left high and dry by the big push into tech. That's when The Exchange returns. Welcome back to The Exchange. 2024 has been a strong year so far for the Magnificent Seven, up more than 17%. But what about the high-quality names that have been left behind? Well, we'll dig into them in today's Three Buys and a Bail, High and Dry edition. And here with our trade is Chris Grisanti, MAI Capital Management's Chief Equity Strategist. Let's start off with your first buy, Bristol-Myers Squibb, down 23% in the past year, but coming off its best month since 2022 as the company looks to quell concerns about expiring patents with two major acquisitions and new treatments in the pipeline. Chris, why are you a buyer here?
Well, John, first of all, thanks. It's good to be with you again. First, let's step back and talk about the Mag 7 real quick. Money has gone in that direction, but they've done us a favor. They've left these other things high and dry, as I like to say. Some of them at record low valuations, record high dividend yields. Getting to Bristol-Myers, less than 8x earnings. It's yielding over 4.5%. It's got $12 billion in cash flow. That's more than 10% of the market cap. This is a classic story we've seen over and over again. The negative story is well known. They have drugs that are going off of patent. Their sales will slow for the next several years, so investors look elsewhere. But what investors are overlooking is that they can use that great cash flow to make the acquisitions that you were talking about, then the earnings growth will start to go up. At the same time, when investors start to see that, they'll bid up the shares. The multiple may grow also. So you'll get a double virtuous tailwind, and you could make 50 or 60% on that kind of name without really risking anything higher than a 12 or 13 PE. So we like that kind of story.
All right. That sounds good. Next buy up, Verizon. It's up around 10% in 2024 after posting strong subscriber gains in Q4. Redburn Atlantic bullish on those gains, but warning that it took more than $50 billion in 5G expansion to get there. So, Chris, why buy here?
So they're making a good point, but I think they're also looking in the rearview mirror. They're absolutely right. That 5G stuff is expensive stuff, but that has already peaked. And so Verizon, again, because of this tech capital grab, has sold off with the other slow-growing stocks. At its bottom a couple of months ago, it was selling at less than 6x earnings. It's done a little better. It's now less than 8x earnings, 6.5% yield. The average multiple is about 13 or 14. So if you can get back just to the average multiple as cash flow starts to increase because the cap spending is going down, we get paid 6.5% to wait. Again, we're looking at a not heroic guess of a 50 or 60% return over a couple of years as the world returns to normal. No heroics here, John.
All right. I see you making that connection. Now for the final buy, Hershey. Pour one out for the chocolate Easter bunnies. Sure. It's down more than 20% in the past year in the face of spiking cocoa prices. Barclays noting that the company is nevertheless gaining back share from Mars after a few months of weakness with significant strength in salty snacks. Chris, you're bullish on Hershey.
I'm bullish on Hershey. And I said there was no heroics with Verizon and Bristol. You got to have a little heroics here with Hershey, John, because cocoa prices are just going up unbelievably. They make NVIDIA look like a slacker. Cocoa prices are up over 100% this year. And that, of course, is Hershey chocolates, biggest raw ingredient cost. So in the face of that, that what that's doing is masking terrific execution at Hershey. So they're hitting on all cylinders. They're just facing a hurricane-like headwind of enormous rise in cocoa prices. So if you can imagine cocoa prices moderating and, God forbid, going back down to where they were over the course of a year or two, Hershey's continues to execute. Investors come back. The multiple goes up. And once again, you've got a stock that's been left high and dry that can take off without a lot of huge risk to the downside, I think.
Okay, I hear you. But NVIDIA is up 82% year to date as well. All right, now for the bail. Boeing down more than 25% in 2024, set to undergo a management shakeup at the end of the year after the MAX 9 door plug blowout was just the latest in a series of quality issues. Citi, however, maintaining its buy rating, citing robust demand for new aircraft. Chris, you're throwing in the towel here. You're not optimistic.
I am, John, and I'd like to be optimistic. This is the kind of stock that value investors like us would like, because obviously it's a great market position. That the aircraft market as a whole is a terrific place to be. It's growing worldwide. But having said that, I still don't think the company has gotten religion. Clearly, there's deep issues of quality and safety that they're working on. So they're going to change management. That's great. But they're not going to change till the end of the year. So clearly, this is a show-me stock. But the show won't even start until next year. So I'm quite disappointed in a stock that I'd like to own. But I think that the board of directors here really hasn't done its job in terms of making the changes it needs to make and also telegraphing things are different this time. So,
all right, we'll leave it there. Three buys and a bail. Chris Grisanti, MAI Capital. That's going to do it.
Thanks,
for the
John.
Exchange. Power Lunch starts on the other side of this quick break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.